What?
I'm singing Limp Bizkit.
I'm going to do things my way. It's my way. My way or the highway.
What?
You're pretending to have presbycusis? Are we recording?
I put it on, 30 seconds ago.
I like doing that where you don't even tell us. I feel like that makes it far more. I feel like if you don't do that, I have trouble being a real person.
Authentic. Yeah, we've been working a lot on authenticity.
I have trouble being an authentic person when I know that the recording thing is on.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. We keep things real over here at Med Scare.
there's literally a half a person listening that's going to get that reference.
Med Scare?
Yeah.
Probably.
You know, I did want to talk about something serious for a moment, and that is what I perceive to be sort of selective hearing that in some ways is interfering with a healthy relationship between Dr. P and I. I'll have to constantly remind Dr. P about things, our friend anniversary, for example.
What? And,
oh, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't. Oh, I don't remember you saying that. Well, maybe you should get your ears checked, okay? And
wait, what did you just say?
Well, you remember our friend anniversary. I sent you those flowers. Now, to be totally serious, if it was an emerge or urgent care presentation, you would want to determine whether there was any serious etiology. So, for example, stroke can present that way.
I was about to ask that.
Yeah, any sort of barotrauma that not only can damage tympanic membrane, which is normally not a huge deal, it regenerates fairly effectively. But if any of the ossicles are damaged, that can be very serious, lead to persistent hearing loss. So assuming that this person wasn't just involved in an explosion or doesn't have other focal neurologic symptoms, I think we can put away the crash cart for the moment and start collecting a history and proceed to a physical exam. So I'm going to assume for a moment that this is Dr. P, and indeed there is an underlying organic process explaining his selective hearing. So let's examine this patient and find out if there's an excuse for sort of willful ignorance in terms of neglecting our friendship.
Yeah, I was tired of hearing your voice, so I put fucking wax in my ears.
So I just crammed the wax deeper and deeper into my ear with a Q-tip. So in all seriousness, I would probably venture to say the most common modifiable cause of hearing loss, that is cerumen impaction. You see it all the time. It's very important in advance of any audiology to ensure that ears have been flushed. So this is especially relevant in the age of digital care, healthcare, that is virtual healthcare, to make sure that you actually visualize your otoscopy and see if there is, for example, cerumen impaction. At the bedside, you can easily do flushing. Just be careful, you can penetrate people's eardrums, so make sure that you have a bit of experience and go nice and slow.
I've done that before.
Really?
Yeah, I saw a whole bunch of earwax in there, spent like 10 minutes trying to flush it out, gave it a little too much of a squeeze at one point, and they're like, whoop, and I'm like, what? And they're like, I don't know. And then I like look in the ear, and I see a busted-ass eardrum, and I'm like, oh my fuck. Shit happens, but you know, ultimately,
you broke his eardrum.
Yeah, I busted the eardrum, but you know, I was just trying to keep it real. You know, I didn't want to change the person
from
who they were when they came in.
Yeah, and I mean, you weren't doing when you were taking that stuff out. You didn't feel like being very mindful about it while you were taking out the earwax. But like, I feel like, and you knew that you might bust his eardrum by doing that. But I feel like you felt that was a sacrifice you were willing to make.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, Saruman impaction. That's one thing that we can consider. Another common conductive source of hearing loss would be acute otitis media, so the old ear infection. Yeah, the tympanic membrane perforation, cholesteatoma, which is actually neither related to cholesterol or tumors, but we can get into that later. One thing we should talk about is the difference between conductive and sensory neural hearing loss, since we're going through the differential here. Yeah. So in general, the way that I would think about it is conductive hearing loss. So this is the conduction of sound to the cochlea. It's impaired. So the external sound doesn't reach the middle ear. And this is most often caused by external and middle ear disease. Whereas with sensory neural hearing loss, then we're going to be looking at the issues with the inner ear, the cochlea, the auditory nerve. So basically there's a defect in the conversion of the sound into the neural signals, or an issue with the transmission of those signals to the cortex. So those are our two main kind of categories, and we can have mixed presentations as well. So the conductive hearing impairment, sensory hearing impairment combination. So that in itself is high yield knowledge. You're going to certainly encounter that on your exams. I would say the next thing that I would strongly recommend to memorize is the physical exam, the Rene and the Weber tests. You know, somebody's coming in with hearing loss. The audiogram is gold standard, but for the fucking nerd that carries around a tuning fork in their pocket, I guess you can do a Rene and Weber. So Rene, however you pronounce it, this is the one where you are going to strike the tuning fork and you're going to place it under the mastoid process, or on the mastoid process. And when you're going to ask the patient to tell you when they can't hear the tuning fork anymore, and then at that point you will bring the tuning fork over to their ear, the tip of the tuning fork. And if they have conductive hearing loss, then the bone conduction will be louder than the air conduction, because in a normal ear, air conduction is louder than bone conduction. A loud sound is going to be louder next to your ear rather than transmitted through the bone. One way to kind of differentiate Rene and Weber, Rene is placed under the pinnae. So the outer ear is the pinna. And you know,
penis.
Yeah. So don't confuse the two. Don't place the tuning fork on the perineum.
sir, can you hear that? Sir?
Wait, you mean that's the wrong way to do that test, dude?
Yeah.
You're saying I've been doing it all along, I've been doing it wrong.
Yeah, see, my understanding was that it conducts through the scrotum via the testicles.
Yeah, you hold the tuning fork up to the butthole.
Can you hear that? I don't think you're doing the real test here.
Rene under the pinnae.
Yeah.
So Rene under the
pinnae. Not to be confused with the pinnae.
So we have the Rene test. The next one's the Weber. This is the one where you strike the tuning fork and place it on the top of the patient's head. And normally, the sound will move to both ears normally, and they'll hear the same level of sound on both sides. But if there is a sensory neural hearing loss, then it will localize to the good ear, meaning that the opposite ear is the one that has the sensory neural hearing loss. So Weber, you can think of it as Weber, it localizes to the left or right ear, right? Ha ha ha. Weather, Weber.
Weber, yeah.
Okay, but is there any test that doesn't sound like it was designed in like 1,000 years ago?
Yeah, the audiogram.
Oh, right, right.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Audio. Okay, right.
Yeah. But it's high yield. It's going to be on exams. Like I.
For sure.
Rare for me to actually have seen anybody do it, but yeah, good one to remember. One other thing to note with those tests is that with the conductive hearing loss, bone conduction will be greater than air conduction at that affected ear, and with the Weber test, you'll find that the sound will be more loud on the affected side. Keep all that in mind in your differential. Actually, we can do a little test right now. So, a little elite medical school quiz. So we got a Dr. P here. We're putting the striking the tuning fork, putting it on the mastoid process on the left ear. You bring it over to the ear afterwards. You can hear it just fine.
Yeah, he grabs your hand and he guides it towards us.
So there's this perineum.
Oh, you're doing the test wrong, bro.
So then you're going to go over to the other ear and you're going to find the same thing. The air conduction is loud, hearing it just fine. And then you place the tuning fork on the top of the head and you find that the sound is actually louder in the right ear. How are we interpreting this?
Left-sided conductive hearing loss.
Sensory neural, because...
Sorry, that's what I meant. Sorry. That's what, yeah.
Yeah, you failed the test, Dr. T.
Yeah, because the Rene, under the Penne, it was normal on both sides, so there's no conductive hearing loss, but the Weber localized to one side, so the opposite ear is the one with sensory neural hearing loss. I hope that's clear.
I think Dr. T needs to get pimped.
Yeah, we're going to be pimping you out real hard.
Been put in my place. someone put a tuning fork to my perineum.
Dude, you know it's a problem when Dr. P is the one pimping you. That's when you know you're too far gone.
All right. Yeah, no, that was good. And I I think I appreciate the constructive feedback. So that's excellent.
Hopefully you'll be a different doctor tomorrow than you are today.
Yeah, you know, you don't...
Hope. Yeah,
you either win, you win or you grow, right?
Because I feel like most people never change.
Yeah,
you know, so it's good that you have that.
Absolutely. So that's that was just fantastic. I think a very clear explanation of hearing loss, the tests for hearing loss specifically. At the bedside. Now, what else do we want to talk about in terms of, do we want to get into, a little bit of pathophysiology in terms of common etiology? So what's the most common, sensory neural hearing loss and probably the most common cause of hearing loss generally?
Are you referring to, presbycusis.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So getting old, right. and you know, in terms of cause, it's hair cell degeneration. As you recall, the cochlea has the cochlea, which is where you apply the tuning fork, has hair cells on it that can degenerate. And there can be an associated degeneration of the basilar membrane. So that's the most common cause of sensory neural hearing loss. It tends to be progressive. It tends to be bilateral, that is. And it tends to start at the high frequencies. So I believe that's, you know, the sort of 20,000 hertz range or 20 kilohertz range. This is a problem because it can cause a loss of speech discrimination, particularly if there's background noise that's present. Relatedly, there can be an inability to tolerate loud sounds. And I'm thinking of my grandparents as I talk about this. So it can be really frustrating and functionally disabling. So again, to summarize, most common cause of sensory neural hearing loss, presbycusis, tends to affect higher frequency first, and often requires treatment such as hearing aid.
Yeah, it's very common. 40% of patients above 65 and 67% of patients above 75 is the data I have, will have our presbycusis. And just remember, it's progressive, bilateral, and does progress down to the lower frequencies. Typically, I think the ballpark is 1 decibel loss per year over 60 years.
Okay.
This is not medical, but apparently fish and birds don't get presbycusis because they're able to regenerate those cells. Whereas specifically mammals, including humans, don't have this ability. So we're actually less evolved than fish and amphibians and stuff like that.
Some ways,
I guess birds must have evolved from humans because they're more advanced, clearly.
Interesting. The common ancestor to birds is humans. Other causes. Let's just review some autotoxic medications because it'll come up. Aminoglycosides, specifically gentamicin, can be highly autotoxic. It's actually used in the setting of various endolymphatic high drops and other causes of vestibular dysfunction to ablate those nerves. So it's very, very toxic to the vestibular apparatus as well. The other sort of aminoglycosides, streptomycin, tobramycin. So just be aware of that, particularly in your young ones. A lot of chemotherapeutics are also highly ototoxic. So that's something that we should be aware of. Salicylates, which is interesting. So aspirin, now is mostly out of favor, including, with the exception of coronary artery disease. But if you have someone taking lots of aspirin, they start developing tinnitus and hearing loss, think about alternative antiplatelets. Antimalarial medications such as the quinines can cause hearing loss with tinnitus as well. And then finally, loop diuretics such as Lasix can cause that. So those are useful things that can come up on the exam, specifically gentamicin. I see that not infrequently. What about congenital causes?
Congenital causes to hearing loss?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about Down syndrome?
Is that a common? Isn't it?
I thought they all had hearing problems.
Never heard of that before, but...
Really? Do you treat them?
Pardon me?
Do you have patients that have Down syndrome?
I do. Yeah, I don't know that that's... I mean, that's good. That's a learning point, if indeed that's the case. More common causes... So Alport is the one that you'll come across all of the time. Alport is also associated with a hereditary nephritis. It tends to be more progressive. As far as I'm aware, they tend not to manifest until a little bit later on. So that will be, for testing purposes, Alport from a genetic perspective. And then the various torch infections. Okay, so toxoplasmosis, HIV, syphilis, rubella, CMV, HSV. Remember, torch infection as a mnemonic comes up all the time. It's congenital infections that can cause central nervous system defects. In the perinatal period, this is relevant to newborn hearing tests. Any cause of hyperbilirubinemia, which, as you guys know, is often reversible and only rarely causes permanent neurologic deficit, is a reversible cause of hearing changes or hearing loss. So that newborn screen, if there's hyperbilirubinemia that present, very often, you know, fortunately, the hearing defect will be reversed. Okay, unless there's crazy stuff, you know, kernicterus, like uber high levels of bilirubin. Good. And what about treatment, guys?
Well, if they have difficulty functioning, then probably a hearing aid.
Yeah, and where are you gonna get your hearing aid? Just
I'm gonna take it out. I'm gonna take it out of my ear. I'm gonna put it in his.
You can order hearing aids.
Also, in severe cases, then maybe like some lip reading courses, some training for good speech discrimination, visually,
nice. Yeah. Right,
that kind of thing too. Even auditory training to, because if the sounds are getting dimmer and dimmer, maybe there's some kind of training that you can do to better resolve sound. Yeah, so all that kind of therapeutic stuff. Yeah,
so, you know, refer them to your local audiologist.
Right.
Unfortunately, they're really high quality hearing aids that amplify, for example, conversation are really expensive, you know, on the order of thousands of dollars.
Oh, really?
That's just the reality. Some insurers will cover them, but frequently not. You know, in terms of so what would that, in terms of other more definitive options, especially for folks that have congenital hearing loss, it'd be on the scope of the podcast, but consider a cochlear implant. So that's a cool option for some folks that directly stimulate the nervous reception for hearing. So that's a cool a technology that's available.
Yeah, I mean, I would say most of this, the hearing loss, the treatment is going to be based on the etiology, and there's a wide range of etiology. Like I mentioned, the cholesteatoma yesterday, earlier in this podcast. Fuck, I'm going to edit that.
leave it in. It's amazing.
Yeah, which is basically a lesion of keratinizing stratified squamous epithelium that also contains the desquamated keratin, and incidence of about 10 per 100,000 people with peak incidence around the second and third decade of life. Ultimately, this is a surgical disease. There's no medical therapy for it. You know, you can watch and wait, see how things progress. Is there more hearing loss? Sometimes facial paralysis can occur, or it extends intracranially. So that's treated with surgery. They remove all of that skin, the dead skin, the keratin, while trying to preserve those normal structures and try to rebuild that tympanic membrane as well. And people actually do have improved hearing afterwards. So pretty decent.
Yeah, that's cool. I've never seen it before, but it's a good thing. That's neat.
I feel like that's not unlikely to show up on exams. Another thing we can think about is otitis externa. So inflammatory inflammation of that ear canal could be cellulitis of the skin and that subdermis, also called the swimmer's ear, right? So people swimming around, they get all sorts of shit in their ear. And then they come in complaining of ear pain. There's like some stuff leaking out. And When you take out your tuning fork, you'll notice some conductive hearing loss. And the typical inciting organism is Pseudomonas aeruginosa or staph, and typically managed with antibiotic, steroid ear drops, and try to keep your Q-tips out. What else we got?
Especially in your diabetics, not infrequently they will become colonized by Pseudomonas and just have like annoying itchy ears periodically. So and those folks in particular, the Ciprodex, that is ciprofloxacin with dexamethasone, those drops can be really useful to help cool off some of that inflammation. Okay. I think that was pretty good. Admittedly, there's a fairly broad differential, but I think we covered a lot of the common causes there.
I think I'll throw in one more, because again, we're thinking high yield here. We're not fucking around.
Let's not piss around, eh?
Yeah. Sudden sensory neural hearing loss. This is going to be an individual who, you know, you're going to take out your audiogram, you're going to take out your crayon, you're going to mark this off. There's going to be a 30 decibel, a 30 decibel hearing loss in three or more frequencies over less than 3 days. So that's the formal definition there. Epidemiology, about 10 per 100,000. And the cause oftentimes unclear, like it can be from all sorts of things, viral, could be something vascular or autoimmune. And the prognosis for this is I think it's in thirds is what I've heard. So about a third of them fully recover, a third partially recover, and a third of them have permanent hearing loss. And this is an emergency. So you're going to send this patient to the eMERGE. You're going to start with high dose steroids like prednisone. And will probably require a taper of a couple weeks. You can also do, for these kinds of patients, an MRI to rule out an acoustic neuroma. And like I said, it's the prognosis is not so great, but... I guess some things that are some factors that will result in more adverse prognostication is if there's really profound hearing loss with onset, or if there is vertigo associated with this hearing loss, or if there's that delay in treatment, hence the urgency of this presentation.
I think that was great. I think that this was covered very well. It was disorganized.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like I've changed a little bit since the beginning of this podcast, but
I don't think you've changed at all.
Well,
you've accumulated more knowledge. You're more prepared to tackle hearing loss in the clinic.
I think we're just as genuine though as when we started. What was that, Dr. P? Yeah, Dr. P, he's having some bilateral acute sensory neural hearing loss. So
what?
So we're gonna pull his pants down, take a good look at his perineum, and get to the thickest tuning fork we can find.
You're gonna get to the bottom of this. Get to the bottom of Dr. P is what you're gonna do. Find out whether or not he's a real guy.
All right, boys. Until next time, this has been Elite Medical School. Leave us a like and subscribe and all that shit. Bye.
Thank you for listening.